Some may say that her ignoring power, in quotes, is a good thing, that it dissolves as we stop feeding it with our focus. But is that true, or dearest wish, or con? How do we tell which? We tell which by having a vision based in our analysis. What is the world we want, and why? And who gets to decide? If not all of us, why? Never forgetting, as I said, that our job as life is to advance the species, not to try to preserve what is just because it exists. And a case in point came up for me toward the end of the week when I heard Cornel West responding to a question from or comment from the audience. He and others were participating in a roundtable discussion. I tuned in late, so I'm not sure of what. And the gentleman from the audience put forward this awesome solution to a high homicide rate in low-income communities. He suggested, why don't we have a 24/7 planning space for youth? And then that's just brilliant and doable. It's workable. It's based in reality. It's not magical. And then he said, don't you think the problem that we've had solving this high homicide rate is that we don't have a workable plan? And then Cornel West sat on his hope with a time-honored, hope-crushing verve of progressive pundits everywhere. As he said indignantly, quote, there is a plan. It's in my book, The Covenant, which puts forward a set of demands to put to the president. The solution, which obviously I haven't read The Covenant, but putting the notion that you come up with demands and petition the president implies that your solution is to fix the state. And that implies that government is there to serve the people. We're going to delve deeper into that question in a minute of what is the role of government? Is that, in fact, its role to serve the people? Because if it isn't, your solution isn't worth much in terms of helping the majority of us, the vast majority of us. But to conclude our look at plenitude, which is the notion essentially when you go to the heart of it, is that we shouldn't let money be our measure of value. Maybe we can close that discussion with these words, quote, the labor of the poor being the minds of the rich. Why should they, the poor, not support themselves by exploiting those riches for their own benefit? All that's needed is to organize them in a college or corporation where they could pool their efforts. This college fellowship will make labor and not money the standard to value all necessaries by, unquote. And that is from a gentleman named John Bellars, who was writing in 1696. So I think we should ask ourselves why these same ideas get cycled and recycled and recycled, discovered and forgot and rediscovered and forgot and rediscovered. It's almost as if we're stuck in the same story, century after century after century. Why is this coming up now? Why are we hearing this put forward by Juliet Shore and Gar Alperovitz and Richard Wolff, and you know, there's a whole crew of them who are saying the same thing over and over to the, and now we have, and that legitimates it as a good, as the way to go, because you have multiple people all saying it, and then we start saying it to each other, you know, over the proverbial water cooler and all that. All of a sudden, you know, that's the center that our thoughts circle around. What the professional left across the board never legitimates with its discourse is the question, what is the vision on which power has its wealth concentrated? Where are they going, these guys? The professional left is always on the defensive. It never asks itself if the right is on the offensive. For example, this consistent focus on voter suppression across the decades. The left never says if the right is on the offensive, what is it on the offensive toward? What is its goal? Is it really just the freedom to rape and pillage the earth unhindered, to amass money with no restrictions? A moment's thought, I think, will show that if stuff is finite and power's eaten the whole, it must have a larger goal, which to achieve. Might not the state, as we think of it, be but means? So is it to get the best deal? Is the role of government to get the best deal for its citizens in the global competition? Or is it to get the best performance out of its citizens so the state can perform well in the global competition, which is more the right-wing perspective? What seems unchallenged, though, is the global competition. The state must win, but why? And win what? Accolades from its people? Ha ha ha, obviously, no. It couldn't give two pieces of excrement for what we think. Well then, strokes from who? The big dogs? And pundits left, right, and center are absorbed with this project. Left, right, and center, they fear, I think, the people have in their minds that the people, the energy of the people unleashed is chaos in their minds. And I think they dream, Plato's dream, of order fixed in place. So this play within a play I've been talking about could be called, quote, perfecting economy, defined as free market and state. So they work like clockwork, effortlessly, in an almost self-stabilizing manner. But that state and that economy are not the ones the people speak of, as that state and that economy, our works still in progress, are yet to be crafted, as that state and that economy are one and the same. Will be is their fond hope in that unfolded day, fixed in place, Plato's dictum, no change. So if in fact, the role of the nation state, of the individual nation state, in an international state system, is to get the best performance out of its people. Is that something we agree with? I think we are in a moment where we are finally scrutinizing the implicit assumptions of governance, of rule over us, of the entire gang, the class system. To illustrate how I think, I often shower accolades on Karl Popper because I believed that he gives us a missing piece of the puzzle, this notion that the art of politics is the art of herding the human cattle. And so many things which seemed unaccountable fell into place with that piece that he brings with his book, The Open Society and Its Enemies. That if, in fact, we are fuel for a larger game, what is that game, and why do we continue to do it? So we have to talk about it. And here's an illustration. I was reading an article by his name is, I don't know if I'm saying it right, Pascal Lamy, who it says is the Director General of the World Trade Organization. And he's talking about this notion. So I thought I'd bring it in so we could unpack it. And as an illustration of how having an accurate analysis reveals and shed light. And this is what I'm arguing. I'd like to see pundits on the left, professional progressives, start to do. Help us develop a common understanding of the moment we are in so that we can collectively, as a species, it is impossible for us to be free either as individuals or individual nation states. We have to do this together. Power is global. So this article is called The Fallacy of Protectionism. And he is very concerned, this Director General of the World Trade Organization, that he's seen a trend of states sort of, circling the wagons, putting up barriers to imports, trying to protect their own, manufacturers and production processes and their products, and quote unquote. And what he's saying in this article is that there's no such thing hardly anymore of a nation having their products. And this is a quote the internationalization of production that had so visibly bound economies together prior to this crisis, this one we're in, was underpinned by the predictable trading environment provided by World Trade Organization rules. So, it's a little self-serving. His organization has provided the framework that will that allowed for the internationalization of production. But what this article never asks, and this is, of course, uniformly true across left, right, and center. We're never allowed to question the game itself, the system. What is never asked is, why is internationalization of production a good thing? Now, I'm not saying that in our future freedom we won't have we certainly are not going to have an international market in any sense period. We certainly will, I think, want to help each other. That's our nature, and that's how we all advance as a species. But the internationalization of production is something that has to be scrutinized. We have to look at this and ask ourselves, why? Why is it pushed in our face as a good thing, and is it a good thing? Now, the closest he comes to an answer to that, why is it a good thing, is found toward the end of the article when he says, trade will always be vulnerable if the efficiencies it creates are perceived to benefit only a fortunate minority. Government action can help equip people to profit from the global marketplace, cushion the blows of creative destruction, and curb inequality, unquote. So that resolves into, we should want internationalization of production because it creates efficiencies. And what does that mean if we have our own Earthspeak language? Okay, but even in the master's tongue, creating efficiencies means it increases profits. In our language, that would translate into it eats the earth faster. Is that a good thing? Why should we want to eat the earth faster? What is the point of our, you know, breakneck consumption of the planet? Particularly because it doesn't provide anything like a good life, even in we so-called core, so-called developed, so-called advanced, modern. We are not enjoying a good life because a good life requires leisure, requires owning our own bodies, requires the ability to create ourselves. That's a good life. That's the life they want for themselves. So why is it somehow for us? Why is there a different standard for us? Well, because their good life depends on our not having a good life. The earth is the source of all wealth, and as it has been depleted, fewer and fewer jobs can be divvied out. So we have time, some of us, and the rest of us, I believe, need to make time in the sense, make this our true work. Figuring out what we do want as a species. Power has taken responsibility for the species, and it is driving us further and further into the dirt, away from having healthy souls and a healthy planet. It does this because it needs the entire globe to sustain itself. We have no choice but to think globally in terms of our vision. And that means that whatever visions we have locally are tied to our vision for the species, that we combine our efforts working towards generalized human freedom. Now, why has all this happened besides the fact that the planet has been consumed? I mean, these are interlinked, the two things I'm about to say. The planet, in fact, is finite, the resources, and so you can't consume them ad infinitum. But what is also true is that we, the cattle, don't want to stay cattle. It is inevitable we will free ourselves. These are not thoughts that can ever be shut down. And I believe it is this inevitable drive to claim our full human gifts, our biological inheritance, which drives forward at base both the consumption of the planet and power's ideological attempt to contain us. So when Wallerstein, in this quote I use so often, says, this is a sentence from it. Well, this is the paragraph I have of his in Waking Up and also in Unpacking Democracy in towards the end in the section, What is Einstein's Definition of Insanity? Wallerstein says that capitalism is doomed, and the issue is what will replace it. And he says this is because, quote, capitalism as a system, he says, it's no longer possible to have serious accumulation of capital because the costs are too high in terms of purchasing power. Capitalism as a system depends on lots of people working to produce surplus value that ends up in a few hands. This results in polarization. If 30% of Indians or Chinese are middle class, a lot more money has to go into their hands. So the world level of profits declines with the growth of the middle class globally. Unquote. And that sentence, so the world level of profits declines with the growth of the middle class globally, is in the master's tongue. Well, the whole thing is in the master's tongue. And this brings us back to the original, when we were doing the propaganda prop section and my critique of the pundit who was attacking Barack for using the word middle class, when in fact his tax cuts are for 98% of the entire populace. All of us are putting pressure on the class system for our fair share, which as we wake up becomes all of it, our full inheritance, which is the earth. As to the degree we wake up, we take responsibility for the earth. And this process of our waking up is a continuous drive forward. And power has had to rely on its intermediary, its shepherds, its pundits, to create ideologies like perhaps plentitude, to try to distract us from our inheritance, which is responsibility for the species. So as we push against those limits imposed by the system, the middle class, quote unquote, grows globally. I think we are at a moment when, I mean, I know we are at a moment where we have to rethink the political scenery and refocus on the big picture. We are being pressured from all sides, left, right, and centered, to narrow our focus local. And we have to refocus big in order to move beyond the mindset of supremacy. That's not gonna go away. And at all. And I think now, as we are all getting on the same page, as the gross disparities have created all of us, one big middle class, being in the middle. Essentially, all of us are in the middle between the shepherds and the sheepdog. The philosopher kings are the shepherds. The sheepdogs and the shepherds. We are, all of us, in the middle between those two extremes of hurting. As we see that it is all of us, 98%, who are in fact disadvantaged by a class system, and that the elite has become narrower and narrower and narrower, and as they therefore can no longer hide. This has been key for them. Their survival is to not be seen, so they hide behind economy to make it seem as if this is some inevitable process because of scarcity, blah, 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 when in fact it has been a crafted play, very much so.